Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Mimiverse Monthly Audiocast. I am your host, writer-director Christopher R. Mim, and I have to ask, are you there? Are you listening? Are you in the future? Are you one of my kids listening to this after I'm dead to learn more about your father and who he was? If you are, let me say, whichever one of you is listening, I love you and I'm proud of you, even beyond the grave. That said, Dark, hi, how's it going? How are you out there in Mimiverse world? How are things? What's new with you? Have you been keeping busy? I actually have. It's been really kind of an interesting month. As you know, we've been very much busy with the whole pandemic thing for 18 months. And, you know, I've been making movies, but have been mostly unable to do events. But, you know, in the last month or two, I've actually been able to start slowly working my way up to doing events again, which has been very interesting. This past month, I did an event in Colorado, the Colorado Festival of Horror, which was really nice. I took my son Elliot and his buddy Caleb, who you all know as Billy Blue. We drove out to Denver and did this really cool little con, which, you know, surprisingly, was pretty well attended. I've done a lot of first-year conventions over the years, and this was a first-year convention, and they had a great turnout. A lot of times, first-year conventions don't always get that many people. It's like anything. You have to build up to a big crowd, right? You're not going to expect thousands of people for a first-year fan-run convention like this. But, man, they had great attendance for a first-year convention. I would actually say the best attendance of any first-year convention I've ever seen, particularly a fan-run one. And the reason why I am differentiating between a fan-run one and a corporate one is, you know, corporate ones have money behind them so they can get big guests that can bring people in. And, you know, this one was fan-run, so it didn't have the giant budget of something like a Wizard World. And so I was one of their big guests, which tells you a lot about how much money they had. And I was sitting actually next to Brian Bonsall, who is the youngest brother in the Keaton family from Family Ties, if you remember that show back in the 80s, as well as he played Worf's son, Alexander, on Star Trek The Next Generation. My table's right next to his, so it was really cool to sit and talk to him about life and fame and what he's been up to and the crazy stuff that he's had to deal with as being part of Family Ties, which was one of the biggest shows of the 80s at the time, and Star Trek Next Generation, which Star Trek, so you get a lot of crazies. And he was telling me a lot of cool stories about being a kid actor and about some of the darker side of the crap he's had to deal with. Honestly, if you ever get a chance, look up Brian Bonsall. He was telling me this very creepy true life story about he had a stalker, and the stalker wasn't necessarily stalking him so much as he was pretending. He was an imposter. He was pretending to be Brian Bonsall and then picking up women at like events and conventions and stuff, lying, saying he was Brian Bonsall, and then doing horrible things to these women. The guy's in prison now, but if you get a chance, look it up and read the story, because it's bonkers. I mean, it is just insane the crap this guy was doing to impersonate Brian Bonsall. The other thing too is, like, Brian Bonsall was this cute kid in these shows, but as he grew up, he became a punk rock musician, and he's covered in tattoos now, like covered in tattoos. And this crazy imposter guy was like getting the same tattoos. So if people were looking up pictures of him, they'd be like, oh, well, his tattoos fit. I mean, it's insane. It's a crazy story. Look it up. I'm telling you, it's creepy, and proves that some people out there are creepy. Some people in this world are insane. And yeah, that was that. Hanging out with an actor who was on, you know, one of my all-time favorite Star Trek shows. Actually, my favorite Star Trek show, The Next Generation, was really cool. But then also just to be at an event again like that was very unique, because it'd been a long time. And to do it with Elliot and Caleb and to meet people and sell movies again. And just, I even got to screen The Unseen Invasion for a crowd that was really, really into it. Like, they were laughing their butts off. Granted, it's Colorado, and every third person smelled like a dispensary. So maybe there's a lot of stoned people watching it, but I don't care, because they were laughing their butts off. And if they were having a good time, I was having a good time. So it was really cool to watch The Unseen Invasion with people who had never seen it and were just laughing their butts off through the whole thing. So that was fantastic and a really good experience, and one that I realized that I really miss. I know I talked about this after we did that screening in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I really miss watching my movies with people and getting immediate feedback, some of which is involuntary feedback. People groaning or laughing or bursting into tears or whatever they're going to do. Or all at once, who knows? Groaning, laughing, and crying all at once. Not sure what that sound like, but I'm sure I've experienced it. The point is, it was really, really nice to see a movie again with people, especially a group of people that were very much into it. And then I also was able to do the Spooky Spectacle Convention in Granbury, Texas, which I've done a few years. And to be back there doing it again was really cool. And they had a decent crowd. It was interesting going from Denver to Granbury. Now, Granbury, Texas is an hour outside of Fort Worth, Texas. It's much more small town than Denver. Denver, it's in the middle of Colorado, which is Weedville. I mean, there was literally a place across the street from the hotel we were doing this convention in called the House of Dankness. We saw that when we pulled in and we laughed our butts off. I mean, I got a good picture of the House of Dankness. It's good stuff. And then you get to small town Texas, which is just, it's a different sort of mindset. It's a different set of people. Let's just say a lot more masks were worn in Denver by comparison to Granbury, Texas. But I'm still very paranoid about COVID. Not so paranoid that I'm obviously just hiding in my bedroom. But I wore a mask the entire time simply because it makes me feel a little safer. And if you choose not to and you feel safe doing so, okay, good for you. We're not going to have a discussion about it. I'm telling you that I wore a mask the entire time because it makes me feel safe and makes me feel like I'm doing my part to keep the spread of the coronavirus down, in addition to being fully vaccinated. I felt safe going to these events. And like I said, in Denver, there were a lot more masked folks. Granbury, not so much, but I generally felt quite safe at both and had a good time. I did better at the one in Colorado, but it was better attended than the one in Granbury. But the Granbury one is quaint. It's fun. It's not a lot of people by comparison, but it's local. It has a very specific flavor that I like. And I got to see a bunch of my friends down in Texas and hang out with them and have a meal. And that was nice. It's always nice to just sort of see people, right? After so long of not seeing people. And in Colorado, I got to see some folks that I haven't seen in years. And that was really, really cool. So it's been interesting to sort of slowly get back out there. And now that we're in October of 2021, I have a bunch of stuff coming up here that I'm excited and nervous for, but I've done okay up till now. So I'm feeling a little more confident in going out and doing things and seeing people and living again, just because I've done it and so far I've been okay. Again, I am protected as a vaccinated person, and I do wear my mask around people I don't know just because, you know, I don't know these people. And if there's one thing the pandemic has taught me, it's that I don't trust very many people. Yeah, so I'm excited. October should bring a bunch of events, and then after that, it's hard to plan too far in advance these days, given how the last year and a half has gone, and I had a bunch of plans that all got thrown into the garbage because of the pandemic. So it is what it is. And so I'm looking forward to all the stuff coming up, and I hope you are too. So if you get a chance, go to my website, saint-euphoria.com, and check out the events tab. I list all the places I'm going to be. Like, I'm coming back to the Jack-O-Lantern Jaunt in Maguanago in a few weeks, which is cool. I'll be showing a double feature at the Far Best Theater in Mansfield, Texas. I'll be back at AllCon at the end of the month, which will be in Dallas. And that was the event I was at when the world shut down and I got kind of stuck there for a weekend, because it's normally a 4-day show, Thursday through Sunday. And I was there on Thursday and they shut it down that night. And I couldn't really get back to Minnesota because everyone was freaking out and I couldn't get a flight. And And I had a flight for Sunday night, but I got kind of stuck down there. And it was actually, sadly, the last time I saw my friend Michael Cross before he sadly passed away now over a year ago, which is insane. It's cool that I'm going back there. It's like a reboot. Finally get to go back to Ulcon and pick up where things had left off. Granted, after Ulcon, like I said, I don't really have anything on the books, so maybe not so much of a reboot as just a continuation, and then we'll see what 2022 brings. Who knows? It's nice to get out again. It's nice to see people again. It's nice to be in the presence of other human beings who are interested in being in the presence of me and my work, and feeling relatively safe in doing so. In the meantime, the Mimiverse continues. I'm staying nice and busy. I have completed the Mimiverse holiday special, and I'm just in the final throes of getting the DVD and Blu-ray and all that stuff together. I have a cool poster made. I don't know if you've seen it. It's actually, weirdly, the first poster that I appear on. In the past, you've seen the Demon with the Atomic Brain poster. Technically, I'm on that poster, but it's just my eye. The eye of the Demon with the Atomic Brain is my eye. That's my big cameo in that movie, and it's on the poster, but it's just an eye. I mean, it could be anybody's eye, right? And it's heavily run through filters and Photoshop, so you can't really tell necessarily that it's my eye. But the Mimiverse Holiday Special poster, which I designed as an homage to the Santa Claus Conquers the Martians poster, I'm actually fully on the poster. You see my whole face and body embodying the role that I think I was destined to play, Santa Claus. And that's my real beard, okay? I'm very proud of my Santa Claus and the fact that, I mean, I've gone gray. My beard is totally basically white now, and my hair is salt and pepper, but it's just a matter of years here before I'm full-on Santa Claus. I mean, I'm basically close enough to Santa Claus now that my body type, I am German even, you know, St. Nicholas, that whole thing. I got the bowl full of jelly, you know what I'm saying? Sure, I was skinny as hell when I did the giant spider, but let's just say for most of my life, I have looked more like Santa Claus than I ever looked like I did in the giant spider. And part of the reason I put myself in the giant spider in such a big role was because I lost 80 pounds and I was like, I don't know how long this is going to last, so I better put myself in a movie for posterity's sake as a physical record of how thin I once was. I am not thin anymore. In fact, I am Santa Claus. So I was kind of proud of that. I think my Santa Claus turned out good. So I definitely wanted to put myself on a poster because, you know, who knows how many more movies I'm going to crank out? Who knows how many more things I'm going to make? As much as I enjoy doing it and as much as I want to keep doing it as long as I can, there's just no guarantee, right? Perhaps my idea well will dry up. Perhaps the fan base will move on. I mean, it happens. People move on. Who knows? I don't. So I figured I should get on one poster, right? And why not the poster for the cheesy little holiday special? It's not like one of the main movies, right? It's just a little side project almost. Plus, there aren't many characters in that little half-hour special. So yeah, I finished that, and now I'm just finalizing it all so that it'll be ready in time for its debut next month. Next month. Probably the night before Thanksgiving. Not Thanksgiving Day, per se, but the night before, that Wednesday. So probably the 24th, I'll be putting it and making it available on Vimeo for people to check out. And for the contributors, I'm shooting really hard to get the DVDs and Blu-rays back in time that I can send them out for the exact release date, but there's no guarantee at this point. Some of this now I'm at the mercy of the manufacturers, and the DVD and Blu-ray manufacturers are experiencing a lot of the same supply chain issues as everybody else. So fingers crossed, I'll get them in time, but I can't guarantee it. I'm doing my damnedest, I promise, to try and get them out day and date. I think regardless of whether or not I get them in the mail exactly on November 24th or the day before, they should be to everybody before New Year's to make sure that you still have time during the holiday season to watch the Mimiverse holiday special. So don't worry, it's coming. It's basically done. We're ready to go. It's awesome and I love it. Now, as for the other project I'm working on, The Phantom Lake Kids in the Day the Earth Abruptly Almost Ended, I still have not completed principal photography, but it is not an issue. Probably within a week of the release of this podcast, I will have it done. There's one more scene to film, and it's my big cameo in the movie, and I have to memorize a bunch of lines, and I've been just really, really, really busy for the last month, and I kept trying to get all this stuff together and done, and it kept falling through. And so I've mapped it out that within the next, say, 4 or 5 days of when I'm recording this, we'll actually be able to shoot that scene. And it's not a big scene, but it's not a scene we can leave out of the movie. It's hard to explain. It's not super integral to the overall plot, but it is important to certain plot points because other things that happen later in the movie won't necessarily make sense without this scene. So I guess it is important, but it's not like you'll be completely lost. It's a setup for other things that come later. It's important, but it's somewhat separate from the rest of the movie in that it's a flashback. And so it's a little different. And that's why I haven't been in a huge rush to shoot it, because a lot of times when I shoot movies outside, right? Say I'm shooting something all in the winter, like Guns of the Apocalypse. I had to get all that shot while there was still snow on the ground, because eventually the snow melts and suddenly it no longer looks like winter and parts of the movie suddenly don't match. Or I have to shoot stuff all in summer because the leaves have to look the same way and there can't be a bunch of bare trees, right? You have to get it all done. This being a flashback could be at a different time. That's why when I shot the majority of the film was during the summer, so everything kind of looked the same. And now I can shoot this in the fall where leaves are falling and stuff. And I actually kind of like that because it is a flashback. So it can look a little different. It'll be more unique and stand out as a moment separate from the greater story. And so I haven't been killing myself to get it done, whereas some of the other stuff, we were a little bit like under the gun to make sure we got it done before the end of summer. Whereas this scene, it's like, yeah, we'll get it done. I'm not in a hurry. I've had plenty of time and opportunity to keep working on the film, even when we aren't shooting stuff, because I just edit. And I'm actually over like 35 minutes of the finished film done, which is a lot when the movie's only going to be about 70 minutes long. So I'm like at the halfway point already, and it's only the beginning of October. And I'm shooting to release it in spring. But even then, I mean, the last few films have been kind of random as to when they were released. So it really doesn't matter. I used to really stick to it. It's like, I got to get it out in spring. I got to get it out. But now, as long as I release it in calendar year 2022, I'm happy. I'm hoping that once we get into the spring, coronavirus numbers are so low that people are really, really feeling safe to go out and do the movies again. Like I was just saying at the beginning of this episode, I've been going out and doing stuff and feeling much more confident in being able to get out there and live a little more. And I'm hoping that perhaps the vaccination rates and the waves of coronavirus that keep coming, perhaps things by next spring, by next April, are at a point where we're almost maybe 90% of normal, that we could finally do a live premiere of this Phantom Lake Kids movie. And if that's the case, I think I want to do like a whole couple days worth of stuff, maybe do it on the weekend so we get people from out of town and it's not a big deal, and do another Night Before the Thing. And if you're like, what the hell is the Night Before the Thing? When we did Danny Johnson, when we did a late night double feature in Giant Spider, we did these events we called the Night Before the Thing, which was a small party that 30 or 40 people went to, and we did a little celebration and we played games and we did musical chairs, which was this goofy ass thing we just started doing. It was a pre-party for the premiere. A lot of times out of towners would give them something to do the night before, and we'd eat pizza. And one time we did trivia and we do all these things, and we just did it up as a thing. And I would love to get back to that. The Mimiverse has not done fun stuff like that in several years. And after a couple years of doing kind of nothing live, it'd be really cool if we finally can do a full-on live premiere of the third Family Kids movie. If the night before, we could do a night before the thing, and maybe we could watch the first two movies together, and we could have dinner, and we could do trivia, and we could just have an event. That'd be fantastic. And so ideally, that's what I'd like to do. That's where I'd like to be in spring. But who knows, right? I mean, who really knows? And that's months and months and months away. It feels like a lifetime away at this point, because we're talking, what, 7-8 months from now? That's a long time when you think about where we were 7 or 8 months ago. Who knows? But fingers crossed, knock on wood, we can do something cool and sort of make up for lost time and just get together again as a community of people who have fun doing this stuff. This is the thing with doing these events again. I miss people. I admittedly enjoyed having all this time to do, you know, nothing, because I was traveling a lot and doing a lot of events and just going for so long that it was kind of nice to have to shut down everything personally and just be home and be with the kids, you know? But I miss people. I miss going out and doing stuff. I miss watching movies with people more than anything else. And honestly, I don't know if I need to do so many conventions as I was before. I don't know that they're important to the grand scheme anymore. A lot of the reason I would do conventions is I would be able to introduce new people to my work. And a lot of that was through sales of physical media. But no one's buying physical media the way they used to anymore. So it's becoming harder and harder to get people to even pay attention or to even stop, because they're like, oh, what do I need DVDs for? I don't even have a DVD player. If I hear that one more time, I swear to God, I get it. You don't have a DVD player. Point is, I don't know if it necessarily fits in with the marketing strategy of the Mimiverse anymore. But I don't know. Everything going forward, it's just kind of up in the air and in the open. So we shall see. All that said, I'm just keeping busy here. I should have the new movie completely in the can and shot by the end of the month. I got some special effects stuff I still need to do, but I have a very big scene in the movie requires quite a few special effects, so I'm kind of editing that all right now just to make sure that I don't need to reshoot anything, because it will have to be nice outside for me to shoot it, and I need to get that done before the snow flies, because then there will be some serious inconsistencies in the film, which wouldn't be the end of the world. I've watched some of my earlier movies before, and there were some serious inconsistencies, but I want to try and get that done, and I'm getting there. It's a long scene, but I'm definitely getting there. The special effects take a lot of time to edit. They take time to throw together and make them look good-ish. You know, my special effects are never great. Some of them were. I still think the final scene of the giant spider where Dan Shervin fights the spider is some of the best dang things I've ever committed to film, but or digital video anyway. Yeah, I'm working really hard on the special effects on this one, but it's coming together. And that said, I should reiterate that these movies are crowdfunded, and without fine folks like yourself contributing to my films, they don't get made. So if you enjoy my movies and are having fun watching them and want to see more, please contribute by going to saint-euphoria.com/contribute_day.html. And that'll let you contribute to The Phantom of My Kids and The Day the Earth Abruptly Almost Ended. And I would greatly appreciate it if you could do that, because again, crowdfunded, without fine folks like yourself contributing money toward these productions, there can't be any more, because if there's no money coming in, I can't go into debt to make movies. I did that in the past, and perhaps by me mentioning that in the past I self-funded all these movies, that's a great segue into the next part of this month's episode of the Mimiverse Monthly. Because we're talking about the history of the Mimiverse, are we not? We are, and we're doing it in a section I call An Oral History of the Mimiverse. In this month's edition of An Oral History of the Mimiverse, we will expand upon what happened after the monster of Phantom Lake. Last month, I talked about how we showed the monster Phantom Lake at the Highway 18 Outdoor Theater, the drive-in in Jefferson, Wisconsin, and how that experience was the moment I decided that I didn't want to do anything else. It was honestly the peak moment of my entire movie-making career. It was kind of the climax of the innocence. Very early on, when I started making movies, there was a wide-eyed innocence involved with it, where I just was so determined to finally make a movie that I was like, no matter what I did, I was just excited to be able to do it. It felt like there was very little drama. Everything was new and exciting, and the sky was the limit. And the culmination of all of that, that sort of like everything is perfect, everything is awesome, was showing the movie at this drive-in. And again, it still ranks as probably one of the greatest moments of my entire life. But after that is when things start to become different. The innocence is gone. The cynicism begins. But really, it's just reality starts to hit you. And you start realizing that there's more to all this. There's a lot of things involved. There's a lot of people involved and a lot of egos. And it's not always going to be sunshine and frickin' chocolate. It's sometimes going to be cloudy days and sardines. I don't know what that means, but I think you can figure it out. After I made The Monster of Phantom Lake and I released it and we did the premiere and it started being shown everywhere and we got all this great press and we showed it at the drive-in, I started thinking, I want to do more. And I had this idea. I said, I want to do another movie called It Came From Another World that would take all the best parts from The Monster of Phantom Lake, all the things that made people laugh, all the things that people loved about it. And I'm going to turn it all up to 11. No, to 13. We're just going to crank up all the stuff that people love and make this movie that would have, well, Professor Jackson, of course, because Josh Craig was very much still very heavily involved in my thinking. We'd bring back the Canoe Cops, because who doesn't love the Canoe Cops? But we'd put them in another situation that would be kind of a Red Scare kind of thing. It'd be an alien invasion kind of thing, and it'd be great. So I had this idea for It Came From Another World, and I was going to take all these elements and put them together into another fantastic 50s-style B-movie that would be just as well-loved and successful as The Monster of Phantom Lake. And so I started to write. And I thought, you know what people really loved? They loved Professor Jackson's pausing. Crank that up to 13. People love the Canoe Cops, so wow, we're going to have more of them. And they're shenanigans. And admittedly, the Canoe Cops are probably the best part of that entire movie. People loved the song, you know, Rockin' and Rollin' All the Way Ramblin'. I'm going to write a new one called Paddlin' Along. I'm going to have four vocal parts and guitar and banjo and all this stuff. More, crank it up. I originally had worked out the idea that we would bring back the Stephanie Yates character played by Leah Horton. And I would get Leah back and it would be a continuation from The Monster of Phantom Lake, where now they're going to get married. It should be said that from the very beginning, when I made The Monster of Phantom Lake, I've always been very upfront with people. I don't have enough money to pay you to be in my movies. I've not shied away from that. My movies are very low budget. They're not big money makers, and the budgets are tiny. And so I always made it very clear to people, was like, look, I can't pay you. I just can't. If you want to be involved in my films, everyone here is basically doing it on a volunteer basis, including myself, especially back then where it was like I was literally going into debt just to make every movie. And I still kind of am, just not so much. And it evens out a little faster than it used to. So I was very upfront with people that, look, I can't pay you. It's all just for the fun of it. Especially early on, it was just like, we're just having fun, okay? We're just trying to make movies. And if you don't want to be in one of my films because you're not getting paid, I will respect that and I won't bug you. If you are an actor or a technician or whatever, and you are trying to do this for a living and you need to make money, my movies are probably not the best place to be because I just don't have it in my budget. Now, sometimes someone like Mike Cook, who's driving 90 miles to be in one of my movies because he lives over in Wisconsin. We've worked out, I'll give him gas money, right? At least make it so that you're not losing money just to be in my movies. And I'll try and feed you whenever I can. And there'll always be craft services and I'll take you out for dinners and stuff. I don't want people to be put out. That's why early on when I scheduled a movie, and this has actually bit me in the butt on occasion, when I schedule a movie, I always work my schedules of when we're shooting around everyone else's schedules. And there have been times where I've had to like work with other people simply because they're not available when everyone else is. It's happened. In fact, scheduling was one of the reasons That Which Lurks in the Dark got shut down the first time, COVID being the second. So I've always tried to make it as convenient as possible for every person who's involved with making my movies. I'll work around your schedule. I can't pay you, but I'll feed you. I'll give you gas money if you need it. I want to make sure that everyone involved is only basically volunteering their time and talent. And for some people, if you're trying to make a living as an actor, I get it. You're not going to want to be in these cheesy B-movie, no-pay little things. I get it. If you're trying to make a living doing this, you need to make a living doing it. And I was very understanding about that. I've never fought with anybody about that, where it's like, well, okay, if you can't do it, and if, you know, someone says, I have to be paid, and I say, well, I can't pay you, and they're like, well, I can't be in it. I never took that personally. You know, I was just always very upfront. You're not getting paid. There's no money here. This is just for fun. But being involved in the Mimiverse, especially now, does give you a little bit of, like, exposure to a nice, decent fan base, right? Which most independent films can't necessarily say. I mean, we have a nice little cult fan base out there, including you who's listening to this, right? And so some people just want to get involved because they like the idea of being involved with something that's somewhat established. Well, back then, I was not very established, but I was still very upfront with people that I can't pay you. I'm not going to insult you by making you feel bad if you can't do my movie if you want to get paid. But if you're willing to just volunteer your time and be involved in this little, what is in essence a community theater project, then I'd love it if you could be involved. I've turned down good actors who were just like, well, I got to be paid. And I was like, well, I can't pay you. And we shook hands and that was that. So I originally wrote the script that Stephanie Yates was going to come back. When I did The Monster Phantom Lake, no one got paid. And I wrote Stephanie Yates into the It Came From the World. And I asked Leah Horton, you know, would you come back to play the role again? And she said, well, you know, in the last one, I didn't get paid. And I'm trying to make a go at this. So I if you can pay me, I can do it. And I just said, well, I can't. Because It Came From the World had an even smaller budget than The Monster Phantom Lake, honestly. Because I was still in debt now because of The Monster Phantom Lake. So part of the reason It Came From the World is such a smaller movie is because it had to be. I basically had a zero budget, and I had to buy like mini DV tapes to film the movie and all this stuff. And I needed a hard drive and all these things. And it was, at the time, it was very difficult to convince my wife that I should spend more of our money on another movie when the last one had put us in debt. So I was like, no, it's going to be smaller. It'll be smaller. And so I'd asked Leah, I said, could you come back? And she said, well, you got to, you know, I'm going to need you to pay me. And I was like, well, I can't do that. And even then, I couldn't even pay Mike Cook to drive in. You know, I didn't have gas money for him, but he was just like, yeah, no big deal. Well, it's fine. I love to do in the last one. I want to do another one. And so Leah and I agreed. No, I can't pay you, so she can't do it. No big deal, right? And that was sort of the end of it. And I wasn't mad at her, and I hope she wasn't mad at me. I never got the impression she was. It was just like, we agreed, okay. She can't do it without getting paid. I can't pay her, so she can't do it. So I thought, okay, well, you know what? I'll just write a new character in there. So I took out the Stephanie Yates character, and I created Julianne St. Marie. I wrote the script, and I finished it, and Josh and I were excited to make it and all this stuff. I had written in this new character, and Leah Horton contacts me after I'd finished it and said, you know what, maybe I do want to do it. I think I do want to get into it. And I was like, oh, really? She's like, yeah, I think I can do it. I think I would love to be involved. I had a lot of fun last time. So let's do it. Let's do it. I'm like, okay, well, I wrote the script with a new character. I suppose I could go back and just make some changes. And she's like, oh, okay, cool. Well, then like we start talking again and somehow we get back to like, Leah's like, well, I want to do it, but you got to pay me. And it's like, I can't. I would love to. I can't. And, you know, it became a little contentious. At least I felt it became a little contentious. I was like, I can't do it. And I remember at the time being like frustrated because it was like, I really want you to be in this movie because that's the way I envisioned it. And then she said no, and I sort of let it go. So I wrote this new character, and then she came back and she's like, I want to be in it. And I was like, I want you to be in it, but I can't pay you. And so we kind of got into it a little bit. And in the end, it just, again, didn't work out. It was like, I literally cannot afford to pay you, and I get it. I was never mad at her for wanting to be paid. That's her right to want to be paid. And we couldn't agree. And that was fine. But I was frustrated by the sort of back and forth, right? Because it was like, man, I wrote you in and then I wrote you out. And now you want me to write you back in. But now I can't write you back in because we're back to the same spot we were in before. And then it was just kind of like, we just left it. You know, it was like, look. You know, we agreed, I can't pay you. I would love to pay you, but I can't. And she's like, well, I can't do it. You know, she's got bills to pay, right? I mean, I hope she was never mad at me. I was never mad at her, but I was frustrated by the back and forth because it was like, I don't know, just I wanted to be one way and then it couldn't be. And I wrote it this new way, which I liked, but then I was willing to go back on it. But then we went back to the same spot. And so out of frustration that like after that all sort of fell apart again, I was like, well, okay. I went back in and just added the, say, what happened to the last girl you were with? Sadly, she died. I was like, I'm just going to kill her damn character off so that we can't bring her back and we won't have this discussion again. It's like, I'm just going to kill her off. And it was really funny because, to jump a little ahead here, we were obviously friendly because she did come to the premiere, right? I mean, it was never, I never felt like it was like we were fighting. It was just like we couldn't agree and it just, the negotiation didn't work. Right? So out of just frustration with it all, I killed her character off. And it was really funny because she came to the premiere. At the end of it, she comes up to me and she punches me and she's like, you killed my character off? And I'm like, well, it was funny. And she's like, I mean, yeah, but come on, man. And actually, at one point, we did have discussions about bringing that character back and working in the idea that she wasn't really dead. She had to fake her own death because she was working on something so secret for the government. But that's neither here nor there. It's funny in retrospect. Because at the time, I remember just being frustrated, just like, I wanted it to be one way and then I had to change it. And I liked how it turned out. And now I could change it back, but then no, it didn't work out. And I was just like, you know, I'm just going to kill her off. Because I had the power to do so. And I thought it was hilarious. And honestly, it's one of those jokes that people still quote. So, I mean, it worked out. Perhaps it was fate that it was going to work out that way. Anyway, well, here's the thing. I needed a new actor to play Julianne Saint Marie. So Josh and I decided to hold an audition. And we held it just at a library that had just like a side room. I've actually done this in a couple libraries. They just had a side room that we could use for a couple hours. And we held an audition. Now, here's the funny thing. In the process of running that audition, and we did it just in one day, like, we saw so many great actors that came in and read for the part that I had a list afterwards of actors who I'm like, she didn't work for this part, but I'm going to work with her in the future. And that actually worked out quite well for several years. A good instance was Brooke Lemke, who appeared in Cave Women on Mars. Now, Brooke Lemke is an interesting addition to the Mimiverse because I first saw her on TV. She was on a show called Invasion Iowa. She's originally from Iowa. And William Shatner did this show where it was a fake reality show where he went to a small town in Iowa and was going to make a movie there or something. And the joke of the whole thing was that everyone involved except the locals were actors playing fake parts, sort of making fun of what small town America thinks of Hollywood. And Shatner was sort of making jokes about himself and his own sort of perceived character of who he is and all this. And Brooke was on that show. And I remember watching the show because I'm a big Star Trek nerd and it was like Shatner. And I was like, I don't know who that girl is, but I like her. She would make a great addition to the Mimiverse. Of course, at the time, I'm like, but how am I ever going to figure out who this girl is? She's just an actor from small town Iowa. You know, it's like, how am I ever going to, like, she doesn't have an agent or anything as far as I know. I'm not going to find her. And even then, if she does have an agent, I sure as hell can't afford her. And one of the greatest weird things that ever happened was, is I remember thinking that when I saw that show, Invasion Iowa, she'd make a great addition to the Mimiverse. When we were doing the It Came From Another World auditions, Brooke Lemke walked in. I was like, oh my God, you're from that show. And she didn't work for the part of Julianne St. Marie, but I was like, you know what? Her and I, we hit it off. We were talking and laughing and having a good time. And I'm like, I told her outright, I said, if this part doesn't work for you, and we haven't made any determinations on that right now, because it was still the audition, someday I think we're going to work together. I think I want to work with you. And I told her, you know, I watched the Invasion Iowa, and I remember thinking at the time she would make a great addition to the Mimiverse. And she was like, okay, cool. Well, if it works out, it'll be great. And it did, obviously. But I'll talk about that when we actually get to Cave Women on Mars. But the real moment we knew we found Julianne St. Marie was literally the moment Shannon McDonough walked in the door. She came in, and I remember she smelled really good. She was wearing like perfume, but it wasn't overwhelming, but it was like a really nice scent. And I remember I was just like, man, this girl smells so good. But she came in, and she just lit up the room. I mean, that was the thing about Shannon that I miss the most of her not being in my movies, is that she seems to be the one actor above all others. And this is no offense to anybody else, but she's the one actor who seems beyond anything else to get exactly what I'm going for. She gets the melodrama, she gets the style, and she's a great actor who commands the screen. She's got presence, which is hard to do on film. Just everything about her, she just worked for the genre. She came in and she gave her reading almost exactly the same way she acted in the movie. And from that point forward, it was like everyone was competing against her and they were all losing terribly. It's like when I actually bought the house I live in. The moment I saw this house, I was like, this is it, I am home. And every other house we saw after that was like, well, it's nice, but it ain't that other place. It's like, I just knew. And a lot of times it's funny when it comes to some of this stuff, you just know. It's not even like personal, you know, it's just like when someone really just stands out, especially in auditions where it's just like, that's the person, that's them. Shannon walked in the door and I guess she just smelled like Julianne St. Marie. I mean, everything about her was like dead on. Pretty much from that point forward, I was convinced Shannon is the one. She's got the job. And Josh was trying to be a little more open-minded and pragmatic and be like, well, what about her? What about her? I'm like, nope, Shannon is Shannon. It's going to be Shannon. And I knew pretty much from that point on, it was like, she's the one. And I'm glad too, because Shannon, of course, shows up in a lot of movies and she's great in every single one she's in. And I need to get her back in something. I got to figure out a way to get her back. But I digress. So she basically commanded the audition and won immediately. But in the process of doing that audition, we met Katherine Hansen, who has shown up in many movies, Billy Joe Cones, who has shown up in a couple, Brooke Lemke, of course, Emily Fradenberg, who showed up in Cave Women on Mars, Melissa Dertzu, who was in Giant Spider, and we tried to get more stuff and it just never worked out. But it was just like, there were a lot of people who showed up to that audition that I was like, you know what? This person is not right for Julianne St. Marie, but she's going to be in something someday. And I kind of banked them. And I contacted each of them. I was like, look, you didn't get the part, but I'm planning and hoping on making more movies, and I'd love to keep you on file for future films. And I ended up, every single person that I told that, I eventually did get to work with. So it was a very productive audition. But finally, we had our cast in place, and we started shooting It Came From Another World. And the shoot itself was pretty low-key, easy, and fun to make. We had like one day that got rained out and we had to reshoot stuff, some of the outdoor stuff at Dr. Fraser's campsite. But all things considered, it actually worked out pretty well. We had Josh Craig and then the canoe cops, Scott Tallman and Mike Cook back. And we had this new great addition of Shannon McDonough, but then also Mike Mason. Mike and I went to high school together. We played in bands together in high school. So we were friends. So it was easy to work with Mike. All things considered, it was, again, it was very low key and very low stress. It was fun to shoot. But I started getting some sneaking suspicions while we were shooting the movie that perhaps this script was not quite as good as the last one. And like I said early on when I started talking about this end of the innocence, I think while making The Monster Phantom Lake, I never really had any doubts that everything I was doing was absolutely perfect, because I was completely naive in thinking that everything I did was going to be great because I was doing it and that's all that mattered. The fact that I was doing it was enough. Well, now, going into It Came From Another World, things were different, because I was starting to see things were not great, and some of my dialogue was definitely lacking by comparison, and some of the energy was off, and some of the scenes were too long. The monster wasn't strong enough, and all these things about it started to feel off, and I completely and utterly ignored them all, figuring, nah, this is exactly what everybody wants. Look, we got Professor Jackson. He's pausing a lot. Everybody loves pausing Professor Jackson. And when people laugh, they laugh too long. And that's hilarious, right? Especially by the 10th time. We've got the canoe cops, and the canoe cops are always funny no matter what they're doing. Everybody loves them. And look, this monster, it's ping pong ball eyes. Everybody, I mean, it's just, this is sheer brilliance. It's not sheer brilliance. It is not my best film. It is not. It is what it is. It's not the worst thing ever made, but it's not great. At least I don't think so. And if you love that movie, opinions are subjective, and I appreciate it if you absolutely love that movie. I see it as nothing but flaws. To whereas all the flaws in The Monster Phantom Lake are charming, I feel like all the flaws in It Came From the World are annoying. And while I was editing it, I started realizing, especially as I was showing people snippets of it, that it was not going well. It was not going over great. But there was something else that was really interesting that happened after I had completed editing It Came From Another World, and I watched it through the first time. Something happened that I think was a major plus for myself as a filmmaker. With The Monster Phantom Lake, almost everything I shot ended up in the final film. With It Came From Another World, I shot all this stuff and I edited the entire script as is, and it ended up being a really, really long movie. And the thing is it's a pretty long movie as it ended up. And one of the things that I learned that was very hard at the time, when I saw the full film with all of it in there, I realized that just because I wrote it doesn't necessarily mean it serves the overall story. Just because I wrote it, just because I filmed it, just because I edited it, didn't mean it's not sometimes in your best interest to pull things out that don't matter. And so if there's one thing I really, really learned from It Came From Another World, I feel like, is that it was the moment I gave myself permission as a filmmaker, as an editor, as a writer, to edit my own work. And realize that just because I wrote it doesn't make it brilliant. And just because I filmed it and edited it doesn't mean it needs to end up in the final film. It's okay to cut stuff. I ended up cutting like 7 or 8 minutes out of that movie. And it's still like 93 minutes long. Admittedly, if I were to go back now and re-edit that movie, it would probably be more like 75 minutes. I feel like I could pull about 20 minutes out of that damn movie. And it would be a much better film. But I'm not going to pull a George Lucas and go back and redo everything. It is what it is. It's a testament to the time in which I made it and the skill level I had at the moment. It was a valuable lesson to learn, to give myself permission to edit my own work, to change something and to pull things out and realize that not everything is important. Not everything is great. And just because I wrote it doesn't mean it needs to be in there if it serves no real purpose other than dragging out a movie that's already too goddamn long. So that was a valuable lesson. But I was getting the sinking feeling after, you know, editing it and watching it and trying to edit it down and pull things out that this movie's not that great. It's really lacking by comparison to The Monster Phantom Lake. It is sort of what it is, and it is entertaining-ish. but it's just not the same. It's not the same movie. And so that innocence I talked of, that wild-eyed, holy crap, I made a movie, was gone because it's like, okay, now I made another movie. Is it any good? And I started doubting whether or not it was. And it felt very much like a weird sophomore slump of just like, I did this great thing the first time, not so much now. So what do I do with that? So that was the biggest lesson. What happens next is another step away from the innocence, shall we say. And that was when I acquired distribution for my first two films with Shadow Creek Studios. That in itself is a much larger story. So being that we're at the point we're at now, I'm going to stop because I feel like this is a good place to stop for this month's edition of An Oral History of the Mimiverse. But next month, we're going to talk about what happened after I finished the movie, picked up distribution, and started learning a lot more about how that works and what that really means, especially back then. So with that, we end this month's edition of An Oral History of the Mimiverse. Okay, so this episode seems like it's a little extra long, but when I start talking about the history of these things, all these stories hit me and I want to tell them all. And there's things I know I forget, but I think there's a lot of interesting ups and downs, especially where we're at in the story now, where, like I said, I got past the innocence stage of the monster fan. I'm like, and things start getting a lot more complex. But that's next month. For now, it's time for episode 11 of Stephen D. Sullivan's Atomic Tales. So let's go on to that.
Stephen D. Sullivan and Saint Euphoria present Atomic Tales, stories of science, mystery, and excitement. This episode features the latest installment in our fantastic original series, Strange Invaders. Tonight, we conclude our heroes' initial encounters with the giant bugs now poised to spread like an A-bomb birthed plague across America in Wings of Death. Join us now as we present another in our continuing series of
Atomic Tales.
Thanks for taking the time to have lunch with me, Agent 3. Rocky.
Suzanne is fine if that's easier for you, Gigi. Even though most people at the Bureau call me Rocky.
Sorry. It's just that I'm so nervous.
About your father, the General. I heard he'd been riding you pretty hard.
Yeah. He doesn't want me becoming an agent. Says I'm too young. Though I think he really just doesn't want me to do it because I'm a girl. He'd flip his lid if he knew I was talking to you during my lunch break. Doesn't want me fraternizing with the agents, or anybody, really.
Dads can be like that. So what did you want to talk about, Gigi?
Well, my dad banned me from listening to the case files, and I wanted to find out what happened after the killer wasps chased you and Agent One down to the lakeshore. I mean, I know you weren't killed, but...
That's a pretty tight spot, that's for sure. So here's what happened.
Ray, duck! I shouted as a wasp the size of a dinner platter came barreling toward the back of Agent One's head. He turned, but not in time. And I couldn't shoot the giant insect without hitting Ray. My partner grunted as the bug hit him, and he went down, his body splashing into the soggy ground of the cattail marsh. I couldn't tell if he'd been stung, but the wasp that nailed him quickly turned to finish the job. I had a bead on the thing now, though, and a single shot of my automatic turned the yellow and black monster into a pile of foul-smelling greenish goo, which quickly disintegrated. There was no time to admire my marksmanship or collect samples for the Tarragons, though. Ray! I cried, kneeling next to Agent One's prone form. The escalating, droning thrum in the air told me I didn't have much time to check his wounds before the bugs would be on us again. A big red scrape covered the left side of Agent One's neck, and his shoulder looked swollen. Stung, probably. I tore away his sleeve, but didn't see a stinger in the wound. Remembering a lecture Doc gave us, I didn't cut or tourniquet it. Ray would have to fight off the effects on his own until I could retrieve the antivenom kit from the agency's Studebaker. I didn't think his neck injury would require stitches, assuming my co-agent lived.
Right then, I had more pressing things to worry about as another wave of wasps swarmed in on us. I blasted as many as I could with my automatic and then snatched up Ray's gun and extra clip after my own ammo ran out, which was all too soon. Agent One moaned softly while I fought for our lives. As I fired my last few rounds, I wondered how long it would take Agent Five or somebody to find our bodies. Damn! Empty! We had more ammo in the car, of course, but a cloud of yellow and black SOBs seethed between our cattail blind and that little piece of salvation. I drew the combat knife from my boot and skewered a bug I hadn't been able to shoot. I cut the one after that in half as it zeroed in on me. So far, my French Resistance knife fighting training had saved our bacon, but I knew that only lasted while the bugs came one or two at a time, and it looked like our luck had just about run out. Three of them angled in on us, buzzing bundles of yellow and black fury. I dodged the first, neatly bisected the second, and cut a wing off the third. I kicked the crippled one into the nearby lake before I could crawl over to Ray. If my partner had been conscious, now would have been a great time to dive into the water and hold our breaths, but with him out cold, pain like fire shot up my back. I wheeled, cutting with my knife, but my fingers had gone numb from the sting. I watched helplessly as the blade flew from my hand into the cattails. The wasp hovered less than a yard away, looking to sting me again. Desperate, I threw a haymaker left as my knees went weak. I got lucky and smacked it in the head. The bugger scudded through the air out over the lake before righting itself and coming at me again. I ducked, throwing my body across Ray's, hoping that I might at least protect him, even at the cost of my own life. The evil buzz of giant insect wings droned ever louder. I looked up, and a demonic yellow and black face leered at me, hovering, aiming for the kill. I'd have swung at it, but now pain from the previous sting made it impossible to even stand. Being stabbed during the war had even felt better.
Sorry, Ray,
I managed to gasp between gritted teeth. The shadow swooped overhead, and suddenly the wasp just vanished.
What the?
I didn't have time to figure out this miraculous save. I could see through the reeds the two more monsters were winging our way. I fought down the pain and struggled to my feet, determined to make the best fight of it that I could. But a tingling sensation in the back of my neck told me to duck. I did, just as a huge shadow buzzed past me, followed by another. I gasped, "Dragonflies!" The new bugs were at least a yard long, with wingspans twice that. They plucked the deadly wasps out of the air as easily as a kid pulling petals off a flower. I once read that dragonflies were the deadliest predator in the world, and these sure were making short work of the wasps. As soon as the bigger insects appeared, the wasps lost all interest in Ray and me. I didn't have time to admire the lopsided bug fight, though.
Come on, Ray,
I said, grunting as I dragged Agent One out of the cattails and towards the safety of our Studebaker. Every muscle in my body was ablaze, but if I could just get us to the car. Ray groaned and actually started stumbling along as I half-carried him. Our Studebaker still lay a long way off. The flutter of giant wings grew closer. I looked back and cursed as the dragonfly, big as a bald eagle, vectored toward us. Apparently humans were on its menu once wasps ran out.
Get the hell back!
I screamed futilely, still half-dragging Ray toward the car. The dragonfly exploded. For a moment, my pain-racked brain thought I'd somehow done it, then... Two more. The ones closest to us went down, too. I turned and saw a second Studebaker parked next to ours, and Agent Five, Nelson Deadeye Corrigan, grinning at us. Thin wisps of vapor drifted from the muzzle of his specially modified sniper rifle, and the stench of cordite and rancid bug guts filled the early summer air.
I got worried when I couldn't raise you on the car radio,
Five said.
Figured I'd better drive out and see what was going on.
Under his watchful eye, the remaining handful of giant dragonflies kept their distance, though they continued picking off the remaining wasps. Seems they feared Five's sting more than that of their fellow insects. I didn't blame them.
Want me to mop up the rest?
Five asked. He pressed his eye to his scope once more as Ray and I reached the cars. No way to tell if those are the only ones, I replied. Time to call in the army. So that's exactly what we did, Gigi. Ray and I got some much-needed medical attention as Five helped the grunts clear the area of bugs of all types, even Ray's fireflies.
Aw, that's kind of sad. They weren't hurting anybody.
Yeah, I guess, but with what we've been through, none of us wanted to take any chances. The Tarragons were pretty disappointed, though. By the time they arrived, there was nothing left to take samples of.
So what caused it all, Rocky? Atomic radiation? Flying saucers? Natural mutation? Soviet experiments? What did the Tarragons figure out?
Nobody knows, Gigi. They're still working on it. Ray and I recovered, and at the time we all thought that Colorado might be the end of it. Of course, it was only the beginning.
Did the Tarragons know this was coming somehow? Is that why they formed the Bureau?
I've got to get back to work. You'll have to ask the Tarragons yourself.
If my dad, I mean the General, will let me.
Gigi, keep studying and asking questions and you'll make a fine agent one day. But don't let anyone, not even your dad, tell you what you can or can't do or be.
I won't. Thanks, Suzanne.
You're welcome, future Agent Brock.
This has been an original story of Strange Invaders, part of our ongoing series of
Atomic Tales.
Brought to you by Saint Euphoria Productions. Tonight's episode, Wings of Death, was written by Stephen D. Sullivan. It was produced and edited by Christopher R. Mim and read by Rachel Grubb as Agent 3, Suzanne Rocky Rockford, Stephen D. Sullivan as Agent 5, Nelson Deadeye Corrigan, and Gwen Ruhoff as Bureau Secretary and aspiring future agent, Gigi Brock. Be sure to tune in next month for more Atomic Tales. Please support the films of Christopher R. Mim at SaintEuphoria.com and the work of Stephen D. Sullivan via his Patreon at PaySteve.com. Join the conversation at the Monster Conservancy at SaveMonsters.com. All elements of this episode are copyright 2021 by their creators and may not be reproduced or reused without permission. Atomic Tales and Strange Invaders are trademarks of Stephen D. Sullivan, all rights reserved. This is the Saint Euphoria Audiocast Network.
Okay, good stuff, right? All right, it's been a nice long episode. I hope you have enjoyed it. Lots of cool stuff coming up this month. Please check out the events page at SaintEuphoria.com. And if you get a chance and you're near any of these places where we're doing events, come on down and hang out again. I've missed you. So let's do this, huh? Okay, that's it. So before I turn it over to Dr. Bob for some jokes, like I always say, be good. But if you can't do that, be good at it. Make sure you contribute to the newest film at SaintEuphoria.com/contribute_day.html. Otherwise, I will talk to you again next month. I hope you're ready for the Mimiverse Holiday Special, which is coming next month on Thanksgiving. Till then, take it away, Dr. Bob.
It is I, Dr. Bob Tesla, with your Mimiverse Jokes of the Month. Because we are in month infinity of the COVID pandemic, I'm going to continue on with my series of jokes about our favorite plague rats, the anti-vaxxers. Why did the anti-vaxxer tiptoe past the medicine cabinet so he wouldn't wake up the sleeping pills? What is 5 miles long and has an IQ of 60? A parade of anti-vaxxers. And the last anti-vaxxer joke for the month. An anti-vaxxer orders a pizza, and the clerk asks if he should cut it into 6, 8, or 12 pieces. And the anti-vaxxer says, "Oh, 6 pieces, please. I could never eat 12. Tune in to our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Dr. Bob Tesla. And you can see every Thursday at 6 p.m. we have 4 tokens where we are playing 4 tokens worth of classic arcade games. And then every Friday at 10 p.m. we have Cliffhanger Theater where we have a chapter of an old serial. And on the third Sunday of the month, at noon, we will be having the board game Betrayal Legacy, the legacy version of Betrayal at House on the Hill, where we do a chapter of that. For October, we'll be entering into Chapter 2, which is actually our third game because the first game was a prologue. And, never mind. It's Chapter 2. That's the important thing to realize. And so tune in. All times are Eastern Standard Time or Eastern Daylight Time. It depends on when you listen to this. Until next month, trust the science.